3. The Frontiero Reply Brief. In the fall of 1970, Sharon Frontiero was a lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force, stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. Her husband, Joseph Frontiero, was a military veteran and full-time student at Montgomery's Huntington College. Under federal law, married members of the military were afforded a supplemental housing allowance and on-base health care for their dependents, but the law defined dependent more favorably for male than female service members. If Joe had been the service member and Sharon the student, she would automatically have been treated as Joe's dependent without regard to her income, qualifying the family for the statutory benefits. As a servicewoman, however, Sharon was required to prove that her husband relied on her for more than half of his expenses before her family would be deemed eligible. Sharon paid the majority of the family's expenses, but fell a bit short of the required one half of Joe's support. Sharon filed a lawsuit in federal court against the Secretaries of Defense and the Air Force, as well as her commanding officer, claiming that the federal law's less generous family benefits for female service members violated her constitutional right to equal protection of the law. When the case reached the U.S. Supreme Court, then Professor Ruth Bader Ginsburg, on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union, wrote a 70-page amicus, friend of the court, brief in support of Sharon Frontiero's claim. In it, she laid out the long history of discrimination against women and the Supreme Court's position unwavering until 1971. Legal distinction by sex, what Ginsburg often called sex role pigeonholing, was rational and therefore constitutional. She characterized this as the anything-goes standard of review. It authorized legislators to draw, as the Supreme Court summed up in 1948, a sharp line between the sexes. Ginsburg's core contention in the ACLU brief was this: legislative line drawing based on sex should, like race classifications, be labeled suspect. So the court should extend to legal distinctions based on gender the same strict scrutiny the justices in the early 1970s reserved and still give to race-based legal distinctions. The essential feature of strict scrutiny, a requirement that the state justify its suspect classification by proving that it was necessary to a compelling state interest and narrowly tailored to serve that interest. A legal commentator famously labeled this standard strict in theory, but fatal in fact, because its application so frequently led courts to conclude that racial classifications were unconstitutional. The attorneys for Sharon Frontiero, who had initially requested the ACLU's assistance with its Supreme Court brief, had declined to make this argument, prompting Ginsburg and the ACLU to submit the argument in their amicus brief. Diplomacy produced a reconciliation, however, and the ACLU and Frontiero's attorneys joined together to submit the final brief, a reply to the government's argument that the federal statute was constitutional. The portion of the reply brief presenting Ginsburg's sex as suspect argument follows. This case marked Ginsburg's first personal appearance before the Supreme Court, where she and one of Frontiero's attorneys split the argument time between them, with Ginsburg presenting the sex as suspect argument in person to the justices for the first time. Excerpt from Joint Reply Brief of Southern Poverty Law Center, Appellants, and the American Civil Liberties Union, Amicus Curiae, filed in U.S. Supreme Court January 12, 1973, in Frontiero v. Richardson, 411 U.S. 677, 1973. Legislative judgments about social roles solely on the basis of sex Invoke a suspect criterion. 1. This court has never to date recognized sex as a suspect criterion for legislative distinctions, and according to appellees, it never should. In urging declaration of the sex criterion as suspect in the instant case, appellants merely reiterate what was plain to those who a decade ago adverted to the pervasive social, economic, and political effects of sex discrimination in American society. Equality of rights under the law for all persons, male or female, is so basic to democracy and its commitment to the ultimate value of the individual that it must be reflected in the fundamental law of the land. President's Commission on the Status of Women, American Women, 44-45, 1963, statement indicating expectation that this court would provide imperative clarification to remove ambiguities with respect to the constitutional protection of women's rights. 2. Appellees in the government brief concede that a prime ingredient eliciting strict scrutiny is inherent in the sex criterion. Sex, like race and national origin, is a visible and immutable biological characteristic that bears no necessary relation to ability. On the other hand, appellees note that racial distinctions, unlike sex distinctions, have an especially disfavored status in constitutional history. This proposition is beyond debate. The paramount concern of Congress in the period during which the post-Civil War amendments were adopted surely did not relate to women, but neither did it relate to newcomers to our shores. Yet the principle of equal protection, from the start, reflected the fundamental notion that legislative distinctions should not be made on the basis of characteristics that bear no necessary relationship to ability and over which persons have no control. In accordance with this notion, in 1971, this court formally enshrined alienage among the suspect categories, Graham v. Richardson. 3. Appellees urge, however, that although the sex criterion bears no necessary relationship to ability, it cannot rank as suspect because women constitute a numerical majority that has not been excluded from the political process. Skipped over is the fact that through most of our nation's history, total political silence was imposed on this numerical majority. C.E. Flexner, Century of Struggle, Up from the Pedestal, Brief, Amicus Curiae, 11-18. Even today, in many states, women do not share with men full rights and responsibilities with respect to jury service. See Brief, Amicus Curiae, 41-42. In educational institutions, on the job market, and most conspicuously in the political arena, women continue to occupy second-place status. Suggestive of the value that should be assigned to appellees' headcount, former Secretary of Labor Hodgson observed in 1970 that discrimination against women in the labor market is more subtle and more pervasive than against any other minority group. Women's political influence could be characterized as substantial, as appellees did in their brief, only by substituting fancy for fact. Not a single woman sits in the United States Senate. Only 14 women hold seats in the House of Representatives. Over the past 20 years, only one woman has chaired a House committee. No woman has ever chaired a Senate committee. Less than 3% of positions in the federal government at and above GS-16 rank are held by women. As of October 31, 1972, women comprised almost one quarter of the Foreign Service, but less than 3% of the chiefs of missions. At the state level, no woman serves as governor, and less than 6% of state legislators are women. 4. Closely related to appellee's headcount argument, and as the final reason for denying that the sex criterion is suspect, appellees assert that sex distinctions do not express an implied legislative judgment of female inferiority. Brief, Appellees 17 to 19. No such judgment, according to appellees, is embodied in a statute declaring women unfit for bartending, Gossert v. Cleary. A statute establishing a women's college to equip females to serve as secretaries and homemakers and in other occupations suitable to their sex. The state's men's college, by contrast, was established as a military school offering a full range of liberal arts and engineering degrees, Williams v. McNair. A statute presuming that women are preoccupied with home and children and therefore should be spared the bother of serving on juries, Hoyt v. Florida. And a statute that has become a major roadblock to women seeking equal opportunities for remuneration and promotions in blue-collar employment, Mueller v. Oregon. Legal scholars who have assessed these legislative judgments less perfunctorily than appellees view the matter differently. Each judgment supposed by appellees to imply no stigma of inferiority has been exposed as resting upon unjustified or at least unsupported assumptions about individual capacities, interests, goals, and social roles solely on the basis of sex. Legislative judgments protecting women from full participation in economic, political, and social life have been labeled benign by persons who regard them as marking off for women a separate but equal role. Most men and women claim they value qualities traditionally associated with the mother-wife, for example, selflessness, sensitivity, passivity, non-assertiveness. But investigations of social scientists leave no doubt that traits associated with the male breadwinner, for example, assertiveness, aggressiveness, independence, are valued more. Evidence abounds that the submissive majority perceives the real judgment underlying benign classifications and the separate but equal euphemism. Growing up in a society in which virtually all positions of influence and power are held by men, women believe that they belong to the inferior sex. Women's lack of self-esteem and their own belief, shared by men, that it is better to be male than female, is reflected, for example, in the fact that male babies are preferred over female babies by both parents. As Martina Horner observed, it has taken a long time to become aware of the extent to which the stereotypical image of woman has actually been internalized, thus acquiring the capacity to exert psychological pressures on women's behavior, of which women themselves are frequently unaware. Social, and even more importantly, internal psychological barriers rooted in this image really limit the opportunities to men. Horner, Toward an Understanding of Achievement-Related Conflicts in Women. 5. Women who seek to break out of the traditional pattern face all of the prejudices and hostility encountered by members of a minority group. Worse than being discreet and insular, which for other minority groups at least has the advantage of fostering political organizing, women are separated from each other and therefore remain far distant from the political potential appellees ascribe to them. For women who want to exercise options that do not fit within stereotypical notions of what is proper for a female, women who do not want to be protected, but do want to develop their individual potential without artificial constraints, classifications reinforcing traditional male-female roles are hardly benign. Whereas in the instant case, a wife and husband deviate from the norm, the wife is the family breadwinner, the husband dependent in the sense that the wife supplies more than half the support for the marital unit, benign legislative judgments serve as constant reminders that in the view of predominantly or all-male decision-making bodies, life should not be arranged this way. Conclusion. In sum, appellants submit that designation of the sex criterion as suspect is overdue, provides the only wholly satisfactory standard for dealing with the claim in this case, and should be the starting point for assessing that claim. Professor Ginsburg would lose the battle for designating sex as a suspect classification, but win the Frontiero case, and in the years that followed, the larger battle for women's equality in the Supreme Court. Only four of the justices, in a plurality opinion by Justice Brennan, agreed with her that gender classifications were worthy of strict scrutiny. But four additional justices, although they declined to label sex classifications suspect, found the statute's gender-specific definitions of dependency unconstitutional nevertheless, citing her 1971 Reed v. Reed case. Sharon Frontiero had prevailed, 8-1. Lacking the essential fifth vote for the proposition that sex, like race, was a suspect category, Ginsburg, in subsequent cases, coaxed the justices into articulating an intermediate standard of review for sex discrimination cases. The court's intermediate standard was first set forth in Craig v. Boren, a 1976 case, in which Ginsburg and the ACLU had again submitted an amicus brief. In an opinion by Justice Brennan, the court said, "To withstand constitutional challenge under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, classifications by gender must serve important governmental objectives and must be substantially related to achievement of those objectives." The new standard, a far cry from the historic anything-goes approach to sex distinctions in law, but not quite strict scrutiny, the vigorous requirement that the state show its sex-based classifications were narrowly tailored to achieve a compelling state interest, proved potent enough to invalidate most of the many federal and state laws that drew a sharp line between the sexes. For Ginsburg's culminating chapter in this battle over the proper judicial approach to gendered laws, refer to by then Justice Ginsburg's announcement of the majority opinion in United States v. Virginia, 1996, also known as the Virginia Military Institute, VMI, case.